Good evening. Welcome to White Lotus Day. White Lotus Day is a time when theosophists all over the world commemorate the life, the mission, the work of H.P. Blavatsky. For some of you, this may be the first time you've attended this kind of meeting. And for others, it's one of many, year after year. So it's useful for us to keep before our mind the nature of this meeting. It is said it's of a devotional nature. But what does that mean? HPB passed away on May 8, 1891. And in her will, she said that if theosophists could meet on that date or around that date every year to read from her favorite devotional books, the Bhagavad Gita, The Voice of the Silence, and Sir Edward Arnold's Light of Asia. And so from that selection, she tells us the purpose of this meeting, that of devotion or rededicating ourselves to the service the highest within us, and the highest benefit to humanity, which is the cause of theosophy. So, for today's format, we will have a brief introduction in the form of a biographical sketch of her life, followed by a reading from the Bhagavad Gita, The Voice of the Silence, and The Light of Asia. And following that, there will be a talk on H.P. Blavatsky and theosophy. So Helena Petrovna Hahn was born on August 12th in 1831 in Russia. And at that time, the Russian calendar in use, it would have been July 30th, 31st, and there was a superstition belief among the people of that time that an individual born at that time would possess unique and wondrous powers. It is useful for us to look at her life in three general ways. Her early life, which will give an idea of her character. The time of her preparation for the work she was to do, and then to look at her accomplishments to give us an idea of her mission and how well she was able to do that. At the time she was born, there was a horrible cholera outbreak in the town, and many people had passed away. And so it was decided that there should be an immediate baptism. Her aunt was unable to attend. So a young girl was asked to be one of the candle holders at the ceremony. And little girl, as little girls can do with services, fell asleep while holding the candle and accidentally set fire to the priest's robes and many other people there were injured as well. And it sort of signifies, in a way, the effect HPB was to have on tearing down, exposing, purifying the religion of the day, of its dogmas and dross, so we can get an idea of the truths that underlie each and all. Her father was a colonel, and the regiment was not too far away. And as a young girl, she spent a lot of time with her father's regiment and showed at a very early age her daring and unconventionality, as she would not be afraid to ride any horse, broken or unbroken, and she insisted on riding on a man's saddle. Her mother was an accomplished and well-known writer. Unfortunately, her mother passed away when Alina was 11 years old. Her grandmother was a princess and a noted botanist and writer as well. So we have the idea that she is from a noble lineage and from a line of accomplished women for their time. As she grew older, she showed more and more of her daring, abrupt character to the horror of some of the servants. She also showed psychic powers, which even terrified them more at an early age. And her friends, as friends will often do, teased her that she is of such a nature that she couldn't even get old Colonel Blavatsky to marry her. He was the governor of the local province. And she took up the dare and was able to convince him to propose to her. It was a challenge. Unfortunately, the law at that time was that once such a proposal was made, it could not be broken. And so she had to marry him. However, the marriage was never consummated. It didn't last very long, and she abruptly and left him. However, she carried his name with her the rest of his life, the rest of her life. And so from that point, with the aid of her father, she traveled around for several years until at the time of her 20th birthday, a very significant event occurred. And this sort of brings us into the second phase of her life, her preparation. She was in London at the time, and there was a delegation from India visiting London in Hyde Park. And among the delegates, she recognized a tall man who she had seen several times in her childhood in dreams and visions and had saved her from potentially very dangerous accidents. And she recognized this individual and went up to him and discovered that he was in fact an initiate, a great teacher. She refers to him throughout her writings as her master. And during that meeting, he explained to her the mission of her life and what she would have to do to be prepared for it. And from that point on, she followed his direction unerringly without any swerving from the lines laid down. And so she traveled throughout Canada, the United States, Mexico, South America, the West Indies, even to India and Tibet, gaining knowledge of various sorts from groups all over the world engaged in similar activities in some way. And she spoke of it later as a time when she was searching for those men and women who would be able to help her in the philosophical and ethical mission she had to do. In 1858, she returned to Russia, and there her family and friends witnessed wondrous psychic powers that she was able to do. She wrote of it later that it was a time when she was letting her psychic forces at play and learning how to control them. And then she traveled around a bit for some time, going to different places in Europe and Greece, and back to India and Tibet. And she was quite a renowned world traveler. But in 1873, under the direction of her master, she came to the United States, because in the United States, particularly in other parts of the world, there was a new movement gaining tremendous force and influence called spiritualism. And she saw in it the potentiality to break through the materialistic tendencies and the dogmatism in science and religion. She at once both wanted to confirm the reality of the phenomena, but correct the mistakes in the theory of the spiritualists. And so we might say that brings to a close the second phase of her life, because from 1875 to her passing in 1891, the time of her public work, she was completely devoted to the founding of the Theosophical Society and the promulgation and placing before the public the most complete public expression of the ancient wisdom religion that had been preserved down through the ages by generations of wise initiates in all lands. This was the heritage of humanity, and the time had come forth for a more complete explanation and demonstration. So in 1875, with the help of others, and particularly William Q. Judge and Colonel Olcott, the Theosophical Society was formally set going on November 17th, 1875, with three goals: establishment of a nucleus of universal brotherhood, the investigation of science, religion, and philosophy, and the investigation of the occult or hidden powers in man and nature. It was clear that such an organization, a philosophical and ethical bent, would need a literature to direct it and educate it. And so in 1877, Isis Unveiled was published, the master key to the mysteries of science and theology. 1878, that having been done, she left for India to give a start to the Theosophical movement, the society in India. And in 1880, she began the publication of the Theosophist magazine. Her work in India completed by 1885, she left to go back to London, where she was very instrumental in the founding of a number of lodges there, and also starting a new magazine called Lucifer, the Lightbringer, where she meant to shed light not only of the wisdom of the ancients, but the errors of the past and the present. In 1887, 88, the work continued, and we have, of course, the publication of The Secret Doctrine. And she says there in the opening lines that it was put before the public for those theosophists who called it forth. And in there we have an outline of the archaic wisdom, not the whole teaching, but the best that could be given out at that time. We might say that it was her mission to reveal or lay before the public that which had been hidden, preserved down through the ages for all humanity, and to attract to the movement those that would investigate it and try to put its basic principles into action. In order to do that, she wrote The Key to Theosophy, which was a way in which students could become more acquainted with the basic ideas of theosophy, and The Voice of the Silence, a devotional book, the practical application of the same wisdom that had been recorded in The Secret Doctrine. So she passed away in the middle of another horrible flu epidemic, this time in London, as we said, in May 8, 1891. But not before she had made her impact in the world, and at that time, and even today more, being recognized for the work she did in setting in a current a society, a humanity, more open to the ideas of other religions and philosophies, and more questioning, more determined to find the truth. So we will now have those readings presented sequentially, and then the talk, HPB and Theosophy.
Reading from the Bhagavad Gita. Between Arjuna and Krishna. What, O Kesava, is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge? What may such a sage declare? Where may he dwell? Does he move and act like other men? A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which enters his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self, through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity, and he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a Muni. True wisdom of a spiritual kind is freedom from self-esteem, hypocrisy, and injury to others. It is patience, sincerity, respect for spiritual instructors, purity, firmness, and self-restraint, dispassion for objects of sense, freedom from pride, and a meditation upon birth, death, decay, sickness, and error. It is an exemption from self-identifying attachment for children, wife, and household, and a constant, unwavering steadiness of heart upon the arrival of every event, whether unfavorable or favorable. It is a never-ceasing love for me alone, the self being effaced. It is a resolute continuance in the study of Adhyatma, the superior spirit, and a meditation upon the end of the acquirement of knowledge of truth. This is called spiritual knowledge. Fearlessness, sincerity, assiduity in devotion, self-restraint, study, mortification and rectitude, harmlessness, veracity, and freedom from anger, resignation, equanimity, and not speaking of the faults of others, universal compassion, modesty and mildness, patience, power, fortitude and purity, discretion, dignity, and unrevengefulness, and freedom from conceit. These are the marks of him whose virtues are of a godlike character, O son of Bharata. The spiritual wife is verily myself, because with heart at peace, he is upon the road that leadeth to the highest path, which is even myself. After many births, the spiritually wise findeth me, as the Vasudeva, who is all this. For such an one of great soul is difficult to meet. What is night to those who are unenlightened is as day to his gaze. What seems as day is known to him as night, the night of ignorance. Such is the self-governed sage.
From the Voice of the Silence. hands and sages of the boundless vision are as rare as the blossom of the Undumbara tree. Our hands are born at midnight hour, together with the sacred plant of 9 and 7 stalks, the holy flower that opens and blooms in darkness out of the pure dew on the frozen bed of snow-capped hop rice. Heights that are trodden by no sinful foot. Know our hand, O Lanu, becomes one in that birth when for the first the soul begins to long for final liberation. Yet, O thou anxious one, no warrior volunteering fight in the fierce strife between the living and the dead, not one recruit can ever refuse the right to enter on the path that leads toward the field of battle. For either he shall win or he shall fall. Yea, if he conquers, Nirvana shall be his. Before he casts a shadow off his mortal coil, that pregnant cause of anguish and illimitable pain, in him will men a great and holy Buddha honor. And if he falls, even then, he does not fall in vain. The enemies he slew in the last battle will not return to life in the next birth that will be his. But if thou wouldst Nirvana reach or cast the prize away, let not the fruit of action and inaction be thy motive, O thou of dauntless heart. Know that the Bodhisattva, who liberation changes for renunciation, to don the miseries of secret life, is called thrice honored, O thou candidate for woes without the cycle. The path is one disciple, yet in the end twofold. Marked are stages by 4 and 7 portals. At one end, bliss immediate, and at the other, bliss deferred. Both are of merit the reward, the choice is thine. The one becomes the two, the open and the secret. The first one leadeth to the goal, the second to self-immolation. When to the permanent is sacrificed the mutable, the prize is thine. The drop returneth whence it came. The open path leads to the changeless change, Nirvana, the glorious state of absoluteness, the bliss past human thought. Thus, the first path is liberation. But path the second is renunciation, and therefore called the path of woe. That secret path leads the our hand to mental woe unspeakable, woe for the living dead, and helpless pity for the men of karmic sorrow, the fruit of karma sages dare not steal. For it is written, teach to eschew all causes, the ripple of effect, as the great tidal wave thou shalt let run its course. The open way no sooner hast thou reached this goal would lead thee to reject the bodhisattva body and make thee enter the thrice glorious state of Dharmakaya, which is oblivion of the world and men forever. The secret way leads also to parinirvanic bliss, but at the close of kalpas without number, Nirvana's gain and loss from boundless pity and compassion for the world of deluded mortals. But it is said, the last shall be the greatest. Samyak Sambuddha, the teacher of perfection, gave up his self for the salvation of the world by stopping at the threshold of Nirvana, the pure state. Thou hast the knowledge now concerning the two ways. Thy time will come for choice, O thou of eager soul, when thou hast reached the end and passed the 7 portals. Thy mind is clear. No more art thou entangled in delusive thoughts, for thou hast learned all. Unveiled stands truth and lifts thee sternly in the face. She says, sweet are the fruits of rest and liberation for the sake of self, but sweeter still the fruits of long and bitter duty. A, renunciation for the sake of others, of suffering fellow men. He who becomes Pratika Buddha makes his obeisance but to himself. The Bodhisattva who has won the battle, who holds the prize within his palm, yet says in his divine compassion, "For others' sake, this great reward I yield," accomplishes a greater renunciation. A savior of the world is he. Behold, the goal of bliss and the long path of woe are at the furthest end. Thou canst choose either, O aspirant to sorrow, throughout the coming cycles.
From the Light of Asia. Pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek not from the helpless gods by gifts and him. Nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourself, deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. Who toiled a slave may come anew a prince, for gentle worthiness and merit won. Who ruled a king may wander earth in rags for things done and undone. Higher than Indran's, ye may lift your lot and sink it lower than the worm or gnat. The end of many myriads lives in this, the end of myriads that. Only while turns this wheel invisible, no pause, no peace, no staying place can be. Who mounts will fall. Who falls may mount and go around unceasingly. If ye lay bound upon the wheel of change, and no way were of breaking from the chain, the heart of boundless beings is a curse. The soul of things fell pain. But ye are not bound. The soul of things is sweet. The heart of being is celestial rest. Stronger than woe is will. That which was good doth pass to better, to best. I, Bood, who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken by a whole world's woe, laugh, and I am gay and glad, for there is liberty. Ho ye, you suffer from yourself, and know ye suffer from yourself. None else compels, none other holds that ye live and die, and whirl upon that wheel, and hug and kiss its spokes of agony, its tear of tears, its nave of nothingness. Behold, I show you truth, lower than hell, higher than heaven, outside the utmost stars, farther than Brahm doth dwell, before beginning and without end, as space eternal and as surety sure, is fixed a power divine, which moves to good. Only its laws endure.
This evening, it is our privilege to come together and consider Madam H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. And we are reminded that in her lifetime, she said, "Do not follow me or my path. Follow the path I show, the masters that are behind." As you heard earlier, White Lotus Day is her creation, but not as a memorial to her person or personality or to her individual thoughts or wit, but it is a memorial, it's a commemoration or a celebration as a signpost on the path to divine wisdom, the ever-becoming of spiritual truth. It is in the spiritualized facts of correspondences, analogies, symbol, and glyph that we find Theosophy, the enduring work and the message of HPB. For she was acting as the ambassador, bridging the gulf between the knowledge of today, the knowledge of 1875 in the West, and the wisdom of the Trans-Himalayan masters. At once, a message that is the timeless human birthright. As Lao Tzu was to China, HPB was to the world at large, the preserver, the synthesizer, the transmitter of ancient spiritual wisdom, codifying old and pure records, resuscitating the spiritual heritage that is at once ours. And think about the symbols that she designed for a memorial such as this. A gathering of souls in her name, but a commune, a oneness of souls. Readings from three different devotional books. A talk evoking the concepts of Theosophy, followed by a period of fellowship, an expression of oneness. And you add to this the symbol, the universal symbol, of the white lotus. And we can imagine how the white lotus is symbolic of her planned message and what this annual or periodic gathering can do to further her objects in the work of universal brotherhood. Applied altruism, Theosophy. She was fond of saying that the root of the lotus sunk in the mud represents material life. The stalk passing up through the water typifies existence in the astral world, and the flower floating on the water and opening to the sky is spiritual being. She said that it is the flower sacred to nature and her gods, the emblem of the powers of both spiritual and physical nature. The seeds of the lotus contained perfectly formed leaves, the miniature shapes of what one day, as perfected plants, they would become. We are taught that it was 18 million years ago that the lighting up of Manus occurred, when the seed of the lotus materialized on this plane of illusion. By communing and rededicating life and lives to the work of HPB, we participate in the continual lighting up of Manus. We attune ourselves with the task of creating the means with which each human can open the heart and understandings to charity, to justice, and generosity. Through self-education and self-achieved efforts, we can create our own paths, parallel or following the path that she showed to the state that she modeled. We can try to create, we can try to envision, as best we can, the self-sacrificing servers of humanity. And just as the lotus has a seed holding the full potential of the plant to be, as it roots in the muddy mire of the pond bottom and eventually begins to grow upward, through the nurturing and yet misty illusions of the pond, so do we. As spiritual entities, we maximize our eternal, internal potential to learn and grow through the material and astral planes. The light of Asia describes the darkness of the absolute and the abstraction of the true self first emerging in ideation. As spiritual entities, we can create and sustain ideas and concepts that lift the race mind, that collectively color the astral light used by all, used by novice seekers and advanced chelas alike. There's no need for the internet technology in the work to be done. We can follow the spiritual path shown by HPB just as the stem of the lotus swells and grows through the watery currents and through the mire of false and fanciful stops and starts. We can find signposts in the dedication of our various publications to guide us on, some of which you heard earlier. And we can use those signposts and the principles which she laid out to guide us in a world that seems to be filled with self-styled spiritual leaders and life coaches and modern seers, as it were. In the jewel of the lotus lies the potential of each of us to defer bliss of materialism and beyond so that others may reserve an impress of a soul life free of attachments, appetites, passions, anxieties, fear, anger. And like the lotus, HPB's teachings and example not only illuminate the world of thought, but fill men's hearts with courage and clear vision. Her writings give us the means to transmit our lives, to transmute our lives, and doing this to inspire and uplift other people. Now, what of the combined efforts established in the last quarter of the 19th century? How do we begin to work with the man in the mirror, and how do we understand each of the three objects? Each of us needs to continue to consider what we can do within the conditions before us to fulfill the three objects that she initially laid down. When can we create the moment to bring each of these objects to life in our own spheres of influence? Can we consider where we were or who we were as soul, living in body, and personality last White Lotus Day? And can we envision how we will be living and working through mind and body next White Lotus Day, working for the cause of those three objects, the nucleus of universal brotherhood in each and every circumstance, the comparative study of world's religions, philosophies, and sciences from ancient times until that which is being explored today, and a study, at least theoretically, of the hidden mysteries of nature, including the psychic and spiritual powers latent in man. That last certainly tempered by our own individual efforts to be as ethical and as pure as we can be. In this way, each of us becomes a center of work for the power of theosophy. As the lotus is a symbol of matter and force on the material plane, as it is the product of heat or fire and water, vapor or ether, so each one of us encapsulates the duality of all manifestation as well as the oneness of life. As we volunteer in study classes during the coming year, let us each of us be mindful that the all-pervading divine essence, an infinite ocean of consciousness from which all things are born and to which they ultimately return, is the birthright of humankind. The human kingdom is one of the phases of experience that each God spark must pass through during its long evolutionary journey through the worlds of matter. And just as the quality of our thought and deeds largely determines the nature of our dreams during sleep, so they also determine the states of consciousness experienced by the inner self after death. H.P. Blavatsky devoted her life to spreading these and other ideas. She believed that they would help eradicate ignorance and superstition, uproot separateness and selfishness, and lay a sound basis for universal brotherhood. Can there be any greater cause with which to live life fully and well? Can there be any clearer signpost on the path of spiritual development? In her monumental Secret Doctrine, she describes the teachings thus. To the public in general and the readers of the SD, I may repeat what I have stated all along and which I now clothe in the words of Montaigne. Gentlemen, I have here made only a nosegay of culled flowers and have brought nothing of my own but the string that ties them. Pull the string to pieces and cut it up to shreds if you will. As for the nosegay of facts, you will never be able to make away with these. You can only ignore them and no more. This is a reminder to us of what a true teacher, a true guru is like. So in our modern world, when we're surrounded by the echoes of Blavatsky and the ripples of effects in the arts, in sciences, in psychology, in the public domain of spiritual teachers or self-styled spiritual teachers, we have a reminder that we can use the original teachings to reach the pure teacher. We may not have a particular body or particular presence or personality with us yet, but we have teachings that are pure and true. From these teachings to the teachers is but a step, though a stupendous one. A long line of teachers exists, known in India as the Guru Parampara chain. Each of them is but a shishya, in other words, a pupil to a mightier lord. The Buddha was always approached by the title of Tathagata, he who follows in the footsteps of his predecessor. The fraternity of adepts on earth is a branch of the cosmic fraternity of Maharishis and Dhyana Buddhis. The development of the inner life feels the necessity of a guide and has come to recognize that the age-old institution of the guru is not only beneficent, but also a necessity. And we're reminded again that she consistently said, "Do not follow me or my path, but follow the path I show, the masters that are behind." And why? Because it was theosophy, divine wisdom, the eternal wisdom, the birthright of all humans that she was pointing to. That each of these masters, each of these teachers, back into the timeless darkness of mankind, each of them points to the same exact truth. In the modern world, soul life has become largely a matter of experimentation. In the ancient world, there were certain key ideas. Those who aspired after the inner spirit knew that a perfectly codified science of the soul existed and that its study required the aid of those who had mastered it, not only in theory, but also in practice. We have that, if not in the physical presence of Blavatsky, but we have that in the teachings of theosophy that she gathered together into that wonderful bouquet for us to use. But in the ancient world was also the knowledge that the only safe way was to prepare oneself and become worthy of learning the science of the soul life, become worthy of learning it by sitting at the feet of the soul scientists, but to prepare oneself, and to prepare oneself very well. The Upanishads say, arise, awake, and seek the great ones. We have to rise to leave sin behind. We have to awake from the dreams of fancy and make-believe before the teacher appears. That is the process of our making ourselves ready, making ourselves prepared. And we're reminded that in the Gita, when Arjuna has his dialogue with Krishna, it is only after he has arisen to leave sin behind that he has prepared himself to awaken from illusion and be ready for the master to speak. So what is the way to the true gurus, to the masters, to the wisdom? The very first step is the search for the science of the soul. The first task of every aspirant for us is to try to figure out the credentials of his future teacher. That first step is to compare all things, and putting aside emotionalism as unworthy of the logician and the experimentalist, but hold fast only to that which passes the ordeal of ultimate analysis. And isn't that one of the objects that the Theosophical Society started with? A comparison of all information known in a detached, objective, impersonal manner in which logic was brought until intuition would bloom. The truths of soul science should be questioned before being accepted, and let every mind test by reasoning out for itself the basic principles with which soul life has to begin. Let every heart feel the depth of the nobility of those teachings. For the teacher, the teachings are the vestures of our teachers. B.P. Wadia wrote this about HPB and the system of thought that she left for us. Wadia wrote, an impartial and critical study of her system of thought, not with a desire either to prove that she's right or to prove that she is wrong, but to find out what were her teachings. That is what is wanted. And then we begin to question. Wadia continued, do they solve the intricate problems which confront us in daily life, 24/7? Do they illumine our intelligence? Do they satisfy the yearnings of the human heart? Do they inspire us to a noble life struggle, to a greater altruism, to a grander selflessness? And above all, are they in harmony with the established facts of ancient science, proven laws of ancient ethics, profound truths of ancient philosophy? The discriminating mind and the intuitive heart must learn to distinguish the song of wisdom from all the other noise and static, all the other welter of the worlds, the clash of thoughts, the talks and the claims that we hear among us and beyond us everywhere on popular media today. But we have every confidence because Blavatsky gathered all that wisdom together, never claiming anything for herself, merely organizing it, codifying it, tying it with a lovely ribbon, and leaving it behind for the first time in known history in written form available to each and to all, in multiple languages, in languages not her own native tongue, but a gift, a pure gift. And now the question remains, as we go out into the world during the course of the coming year, do we see ourselves as adult children of light, are we about to do service and to seek the truth among all of the latter-day so-called life coaches? Are we available to help others seeking to rise, to awaken, and to discern? We have plenty of time to do what she had asked in her will, and that is to have a period of fellowship and to share ideas and concepts about H. P. Blavatsky and Theosophy.